Welcome back to Issues Etc. In the last half hour, we continue our conversation with Dr. Mark Holthoff on how to argue with a teacher. This applies not only to kids in college, but increasingly kids in high school find themselves faced with this as well. But this is me, okay? I am a product of parochial Lutheran schools from kindergarten until post-seminary graduate work. I can honestly say, with very few exceptions, and this would have been in the college level of Lutheran colleges, I never ran across a teacher who did not have, at the very least, a very healthy Christian worldview, and for all I could tell, affirmed the teachings and the views of historic Christianity. So for me to walk into a university classroom would be a shock indeed. And it, for the most part, it was an old view of education as well. Things like truth and morality and virtue and wisdom were understood as givens in this model of education. So what do you do when that's not the norm anymore, and it isn't the norm anymore? Dr. Mark Holthoff is our guest. Dr. Holthoff, talk about the new view of education that somebody like me who, say, went to Lutheran grade school, Lutheran high school, or a parochial school for that matter, enters into the university classroom, and the whole educational system, the whole way of viewing education as an enterprise, is different than what they're expecting.
Well, that's a big subject to talk about. There are a number of different ways to come at it. One of them begins with the assumption that schools existed for a particular purpose, and that that purpose had something to do with understanding what a human being was and what the purpose of his life was. Insofar as there is a religious underpinning to much of education, the purpose of education was to perfect man insofar as he could be perfected in this life. Of course, we know that that's limited, but it was meant to improve his mind, improve his heart, furnish and discipline his mind. And one did that for its own sake because we were doing those things that God made us to do. In fact, that was often called the academic dogma, the unquestioned reason why we studied, namely that knowledge was worth pursuing for its own sake because it made us better, able to do what we were. Interestingly, not too long, about a generation ago, a book by the sociologist Robert Nisbet was published called The Degradation of the Academic Dogma, the idea that this is declining and falling apart, that things aren't worth studying for their own sake, but they have to be justified in terms of some practical utilitarian purpose, in terms of maybe technology or getting a job. Now, I don't want to argue against the goodness of technology. I wouldn't be talking to you now without it, and we all need jobs. But there's a more sublime and higher reason that we might want to pursue education, and that's fallen into disrespect. For example, if we look at one of the fundamental organic laws of our nation, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, the Northwest Ordinance begins Article 3 saying, "Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to the good government and the happiness of mankind, schools shall forever be encouraged in the land." Notice the premise there, that if we want human beings to be happy, and by happy we mean that in the broadest philosophical sense of living life as they're called to live by their Creator in conformity with God's will, if we want to have ordered civil society, good government, then where do we begin? We encourage religion, morality, and knowledge in that order. And where should those things be encouraged? In schools. So the fundamental purpose of the old view was that schools were here to encourage religion and morality and knowledge. Today, this question about religion and morality have fallen onto touchy grounds. Partly this has to do with misunderstanding of the First Amendment and its application in the 20th century. The idea that somehow if we talk about religion or encourage fixed morality in the schools, we're being intolerant, or we're imposing religion, or we're violating the First Amendment. And so instead, what we get in schools today is not so much talking about fixed things, like virtues, but transient things that are not fixed, like values. So today we have lots of values language. We have family values, we have feminist values, we have gay values, classical values, atheist values, and so on. That's because values are relative, they're not fixed. And so I can happily say, well, you have your values, I have mine, who's to say? But to talk about virtue in the old way is to talk about fixed things. And when we talk about fixed things, you're either with us or against us. So, for example, virtue. Virtue, the old cardinal virtues, there were four of them, justice, prudence, temperance, and fortitude. Comes from that word cardo, which means hinge. All moral excellence turns or hinges, the Greeks thought, on the acquisition of these moral virtues. Of course, since Christianity, that list has expanded. We can talk about fruits of the Spirit. We can talk about faith, hope, and love. But these things are fixed. It's very hard to talk about fixed things in a context of a culture that wants to dissipate those with values that are not unique or not able to transcend groups, but are group-specific. And so consequently, we get discussion in schools about people primarily not as individuals accountable to their God, but as people as part of groups. So we start talking about groups in terms of what gender you are, what race you are, what class you are, what ethnic origin you are, what identity you have for yourself as part of a group, but not as an individual. And so much of education now is clouded by group identity politics and relativistic values language. And, of course, when this is the case, nothing's fixed, and if nothing's fixed, all we have to do is be tolerant of one another. And tolerance becomes the only fixed virtue left as we seek to do something called celebrating diversity. Almost everywhere you go, from kindergarten to college today, you'll hear schools talk about diversity, celebrating diversity, encouraging diversity, tolerating diversity. It's necessary in the view of many because there's nothing that transcends all the different group identities that's simply fixed. And so somebody grounded in the old view who wanders into this is going to be comfortable with talking about things as good or evil, as white or black, or as something to be pursued or something to be avoided. But that kind of language often is difficult to find a comfortable home in an educational setting that talks about difference all the time.
So at the very outset, when the student is considering raising an objection, arguing with the teacher either in or outside the classroom, they need to understand that there may well be a bit of perplexity on the part of the teacher if a question is raised, because argument under the system you've just described, where everything is subjective, everything is reduced merely to either group identity or personal preference, arguing there would be an exercise in futility. Why would I want to convince anyone else of my viewpoint? Everyone has their own truth.
Well, that's true. That becomes a very difficult challenge, and it's actually complicated even more by this, and I can counter students in my classroom here on my campus who have come from, say, a large public school background where they haven't had the same kind of educational background that you described for yourself. They might be saying something that is completely in accord with the old views that I've described, but in order not to give offense, they will say to their classmate or they will say to the professor, but of course, that's just my opinion. And in other words, it's a way for them to qualify their position and not make it offensive by saying that, well, I have my opinion, you have yours, but there's really no way to adjudicate between them. Of course, this puts me in mind of that great quote by John Erskine, who was the founder of the Great Books Movement at Columbia University. He said, opinion is that exercise of the human will which helps us to make a decision without information. When we live in a world where opinion becomes the arbitrator of all decisions, we're actually wallowing in a sea that says we don't want to get down to the brass tacks, to the foundation of truth. We want to keep our feet comfortably 3 feet off the ground so where we can't stub our toes against reality.
Let's make a distinction here if we could, and that is, and this has come in a different context, kind of come to light for me. There is a difference between the postmodernist who's making his very best attempt to hold to the dogmas of postmodernism, that there is no absolute truth. And it's hard to do, but many do make a valiant attempt to try and do that. And the more, I think, more popular postmodern view, which is, while there may be objective truth, we can't know it. So the best we can hope for is each person's individual interpretation or perspective on that truth. Is that a important thing to understand going into this classroom scenario?
I think it probably is. Of course, that idea that there may be objective truth, but we can't know it, is just a dressed-up form of Thomas Henry Huxley's term that he coined, and he was a 19th-century figure. He was the great bulldog defender of Darwin. He coined the term agnosticism, and he did it. He said the agnostic isn't someone who just says, well, I don't know, you may. But it was the one who had his principled ignorance, who said there are some things about which we just cannot know. And if you say you do, you're mistaken, because we can't have knowledge about those things. So this postmodernist that you're talking about would be a revived form of that agnosticism that says there are many realities that we would like to have certainty about, but that's not available. So all we have is our relative perspectives on that, and we do the best we can with what we with what we've been given. It's interesting that it poses as a kind of intellectual humility, but it's simply posing as that, because when you turn the tables onto that agnostic and you ask him, well, okay, so you're telling me that you know for certain that we can't know. How do you know that? And it turns out that that very agnostic turns out to be just as dogmatic and certain about his uncertainty and that I can't have knowledge as I am that I think I do know something. So we still run into two absolutists who are bumping into one another. And that's a serious problem, but it's a serious problem that many students and many faculty members perhaps don't recognize. I found myself with a number of students in a student group at a lecture not too long ago. The subject of all things was biological evolution. And toward the end of the question and answer session, I asked the presenter whether or not he knew to be the case the things about the scientific method that he claimed, and whether science was a superior form of knowledge to others. And to that answer, he said, well, my view is that the scientific method, because it's reliable, is, in my opinion, the best form of knowledge. So I asked, well, do you know that to be the case? He said, well, to me, that's the best form of knowledge, but of course, that's just my opinion, and you may have another form of knowledge. So here was somebody even trying to defend scientific naturalism, rock-solid certainty, but because he had himself been sufficiently influenced by this postmodernist view, wasn't willing to say that he was even certain absolutely about the things that he was certain about. So in a sense, there was a certain honesty there, but it's a real problem for anyone who wants to be that postmodernist, because he's wanting to have it both ways. He wants to claim the intellectual humility of one who is sure that he doesn't know, at the same time that his certainty of his ignorance is a new kind of rock-solid certainty.
Here's a scenario that did not take place in the classroom, but in fact on the airwaves of this program recently. And I found myself a little stymied, but I imagine this could happen to a student debating a teacher with a completely different worldview. I was talking with, I think it was Dr. Bart Ehrman, who is rather famous for trying to discount much of the New Testament. And we were having a conversation, and I asked at one point, Dr. Ehrman, upon what objective criteria do you decide which passages of the New Testament you keep, which you throw out? And he said, I don't know what you mean. I backed up, came at it again a different way, again asking for some objective criteria. He said, I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean. Finally, after some trial and error, he said, this stuff you're talking about, objective criteria, objective truth, I do not recognize the objective-subjective distinction.
Right.
And I found myself kind of stymied and not knowing whether or not the argument or the discussion was over. The student who finds himself in that position, is the discussion over at that point?
Well, it might be. And of course, the purpose, this is where we, you know, backing up to the student for a moment, this is where the student has to learn to pick his battles. I went to graduate school at a very large university, a very large liberal university, and there were some students who decided it was their place to pick fights with their professors. There were others who said, wait a minute, I'm here to get a credential. My battleground is going to be in a larger world. What I need to do is learn what my professor can teach me. He's not my student, but someday I might have students or neighbors or coworkers who I can effectively argue with, and I may not gain any traction here, and indeed I might hurt myself if this professor sees me as an enemy. He may get in the way of my progress. My goal is to learn what his perspective is, even if I'm not compelled by it. I'm reminded of John Stuart Mill's famous line, he who knows only his own side of a view knows little at that. It may be that the student can only take away from his classroom experience what the professor's view is and not succeed in persuading him, because the professor may not be susceptible to that kind of persuasion. But if he's going to try, the best thing to do is to ask the questions that get at the base of the professor's concern. You raise, for example, the objective-subjective distinction. This quest for objective knowledge and what might be called Cartesian certainty is something that has eluded us. And because it's eluded us, it's easy to fall off the horse the other way and say, well, because I can't know everything with the same certainty that I know 2 plus 2 is 4, then maybe I can know nothing. And, of course, that's a mistake that one shouldn't make, but it's become a fashionable mistake. And I don't think that a student has to be sucked into playing along with that.
Our guest is Dr. Mark Kaltoff. We're talking about how to argue with the teacher. Perhaps you have an experience arguing with the teacher. You can give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us in the few minutes left here, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Kaltoff is chairman of the Department of History and Political Science at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, and he made a presentation at a recent Higher Things Youth Conference titled How to Argue with Teachers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. You do speak at one point, and you mentioned this early on in our conversation, about finding common ground. What is the best method of approaching that when you do have, let's say, worst case scenario, you do have this gulf between teacher and student? What's the best way of pursuing the common ground, and to what end is that done?
My view is that the best way to find common ground is, and this would be for the student talking to the professor who he thinks he has a disagreement with, or the professor talking to the student who the professor is trying to persuade because the student seems not to be on the same path with him, is to verbalize as clearly as you can what you think your opponent's view is, in a way that that opponent will say, yes, you have fairly expressed my view. As a professor myself, I am routinely given the responsibility to teach about ideas of people in the past with whom I don't agree. And I always take it upon myself when I teach a view of somebody that I don't, that I'm not ultimately sympathetic with, to imagine myself teaching it as if that person or a proponent of that position were sitting in the front row of my class. Would that person be nodding in assent and say, yep, that guy's got it pretty much right? I think a student who wants to persuade a professor or a teacher should begin by saying, now, do I understand you right? I understand you to be saying X, Y, and Z, and not A, B, and C. Do I have that right? And it very well may be the case that the professor will respond by saying, no, not quite. It really should be this, this, and this. And that will open the door for the kind of dialogue that will allow the student to work toward that point of faithfully presenting the professor's position. Then once the professor has given his assent that you've got it right, you can begin then by asking questions. Well, what about this? Or what about that? And that will open the dialogue where the professor will have to be put on the defensive because he's already conceded that you understand his point.
So at the very least, the student can, in each and every case, find that small piece of common ground that is, we both I understand and are able to articulate your position, although I disagree with it. That, is, at the very least, is the common ground the student can find with the teacher.
I think so. I think that has to be a starting point, because as long as the professor can step back and say to the student, look, you're being recalcitrant, you don't understand what I'm trying to say to you, the professor is not going to persuade him of anything. There's a certain charity, a magnanimity on the part of the student that says, I will come over onto your ground for a minute and at least show you that I understand what you're saying. That wins brownie points with a teacher. It also might be a good way to review for an exam and get a good grade.
Speak finally here, if you would, about those who will inevitably be listening in to a classroom discussion that may involve a bit of give and take between a student and his teacher with whom he disagrees.
The student who's not participating, just listening.
Yes.
Right.
Who also may be persuaded by kind of secondhand conversation. Got about a minute here, or no more than a minute, in fact.
You make a very good point. This is another reason for the student, by the way, who is arguing with the teacher to be very careful. His primary opponent, his primary person he might be able to persuade, may not be the professor. It may be his classmate who is really sitting on the fence. And that's where the student also needs to exercise that intellectual humility toward the professor and not pose as if he knows it all, because he actually may be able to persuade his classmate, unless the classmate writes him off as somebody who is arrogant and disrespectful toward his professor. So the student's classmates may actually be the primary people that a student who thinks he has a good argument against the professor can influence in the course of a debate.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff is chairman of the Department of History and Political Science at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. He made a presentation at a recent Higher Things Youth Conference titled How to Argue with Teachers. Dr. Kaltoff, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're quite welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Well, as we approach the end of this year, year-end giving becomes something that people think about. They sit down to write the bills, and then they think about those relief agencies that they might want to send a few extra dollars near the end of the year. LCMS World Relief, keep it at the top of your list. It is Christ-centered, cross-focused relief around the world. To find out more, all you got to do is go to our webpage, issuesetc.org, and find their logo there on the homepage, LCMS World Relief. That'll be all the information you need. You can also call them toll-free and directly, 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. LCMS World Relief is concerned with both body and soul. And as you're sitting down for that year-end giving, think about Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. Well, tune in tomorrow to Issues Etc. The subject will be, among other things, Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam. Dr. Adam Francisco of Concordia College in Bronxville, New York, will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.